myself sorted here. My name's Annie and I'm an addict.
Hi, Annie.
I'm Australian and I'm an artist and I'm also a pagan. So that gets it out of the way. Peter asked me if I was nervous and I said, oh, not really, I just block it out of my mind. But I am, and what I do is take my glasses off. I can't see this now. You're all just little blurs out there. It's great. Yeah, this is my home group, and I've been sort of coming here since it started, really, and I've done shares here before, and it's really nice. I haven't done one for a little while, I don't think. I can't remember when. But it's really nice to be here in a meeting, and some of you probably think, oh, God, here she goes again, you know, a bit boring. But that's the way it is. So take it or leave it. My story. I've lived a long time, so it's pretty long, you know. I'm a baby boomer, born just after the Second World War, not the first. There hasn't been any work done, so I'm not too sure. Yeah, I was born in 1947, so I'm nearly 64. So I've lived a long time, and I did a lot of drugs. So I have to break it down into decades for you. So because my memory doesn't sort of span, you know, it can't jump around anymore. So obviously, till 1950, I didn't use. You know, I was three. So, and I didn't actually use for another 10 years after that. But I was born in Middlesex, and in a place called Stanmore. And when I was about four, my family moved to Chichester, a nice little village just outside Chichester, very twee. Lovely thatched cottage, you know, the whole bit, loads of land, very special. I didn't realise it at the time. It's just when I've come back to England and gone to visit, and I thought, wow, did I grow up there, you know, because you just take it for granted wherever you are as a child, I think, because it's your normality. So I was very lucky to have, you know, quite a privileged lifestyle as a child. And I lived in a three-generational household, my grandparents, my parents, and my brother and I, and everything was sort of pretty good. You know, I didn't really want for anything. We didn't have loads and loads, but I didn't really need for anything particularly, you know. The 50s was quite an idyllic time, really, I think, for everybody. Of course, many of you here weren't even thought of it in the 1950s, but it was a very nice time. And in 1959, my parents decided to emigrate to Australia. And we went on a ship from Tilbury Docks to Melbourne, which took 5 weeks, so that was quite an adventure. There was lots of migrants on the ship, and it was a time of change. You know, lots of people were moving around the world then. And we got to Australia, and my family had a party on that first day because my brother and my dad had brothers and sisters there. And that was my first day of getting drunk. So I remember it specifically because it was sort of, you know, fairly auspicious. You just landed on the other side of the world and you end up getting pissed, you know. So the two of them, well, everyone else was celebrating. So my brother and my cousin and I decided we probably needed to celebrate too. And I think a lot of people, what I've heard is, you know, that's how they had their first drunk, was sort of under the guise of, you know, the parents or relatives sort of not taking any notice. And so I was sick, and I think I created a bit of a storm, you know, which I did through most of my using, actually. And 32 years later, I had my final intake of, you know, substances. So that's why I need to break it down for you guys, because it's easier for me. So, okay, we've got 1959, Christmas 1959, so the 60s are looming. What a great time. I am so glad I was born in 1947. Really, because that was the best decade there's ever been. I've got to tell you that. Peter was talking about, you know, different types of drugs. Well, of course, they were all brand new. I mean, some of them have been around, like cocaine and heroin have been around forever and ever and ever, but not accessible to everyone. And the 60s were really, you know, experimental. You know, we were... Well, I was only a kid in 1960, but, you know, and I was still at school too, but I left school at 14 and got a job, because that's what you did in those days. You went to work, and there was loads and loads of jobs anyway. You know, you could have three in a day if you wanted, you know, there was just max jobs. And when I was 15, I had a child, and I mention this for the women that have been parted from their children, because I'm a survivor of the Magdalena sisters, and I'm really good at laundry. That's on my CV. Because I learned a lot about laundry with the beautiful nuns. I love them. And I'm pagan as well, and when I tell my story, you can understand why. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of that anyway. It was part of my life and it happened, and my child was taken away from me. And the counselling that I had was never speak of it again. So, and then you're sent on your merry way and you go back to work and you forget about it, you know. So, I never forgot. And the happy part is that I have contact with that daughter now, you know, and I have three grandchildren as well. She's 48 years old, so, and she lives in Australia. So that, you know, to get over, while you're feeling sad, I'm going to tell you that it's got a happy ending. We don't want any tears tonight. So then, what happened then? Yeah, I went to Sydney then and got a job as a dancer in one of the clubs, and that was pretty good, and I got introduced to amphetamines at that time. So I was about 16 and a half, maybe 17, something like that. Underage anyway, still common knowledge, isn't it, you know, when you're that age. So so I thought about that. I wasn't the one that was going to get busted, was I? So I didn't think about anything if it comes to that, really. I just went through my life with not really assessing anything. It just happened. I had a thought in the morning and I acted on it by lunchtime. There was no planning, no thought. I didn't have those capabilities, or I didn't think I had. And if I did, I certainly didn't utilise them. So I lived in Sydney for a little while, and you know, now I've found the magical drug of speed, which I used for the rest of my using life as well. It was in pill form in those old days, and it was really nice, you know. You could stay up for a week, you know, you could probably stay up forever, you know. It was really good shit. It was really good, and I loved it. And Bacardi had just come out as well. So I'm pretty old, isn't I? I tell you these things. Bacardi and Coke was the in drink. It's like cat's piss. Anyone that drinks Bacardi and Coke really needs to get a life, I think. So anyway, that was in at the time. And me being the fashionable one, drank quite a lot of it. And then I decided to go back to Melbourne, and some friends of mine at that time found this pub in Melbourne that all the merchant seamen used to go to, and I thought, this sounds all right to me, I think I'll have a bit of that. So I joined up with this gang, and we used to go on merchant ships and drink and shag and just have a general good time, really. And this is about 1966, something like that. I'd already seen the Beatles by then and the Stones as well. I'll throw that one in. So and that's pretty cool. Bet not too many of you have seen the Beatles live. And so we started knocking around on the ships, and it was really good because they had bars on board, and You know, it was duty free. Not as though we were paid for anything anyway, but it was duty free, and it was a good laugh. It was an amazing laugh. You know, we've got a reunion site on Facebook now, and there's all these old codgers because we're all really old, all like our faces on Facebook, and it's like God. He's really old, you know, then you have to look in the mirror. Because we were all so young. Like some of the pictures off the ships, like these boys were so young, like 15, 16, 17, first going to sea and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, I ended up marrying one of them. So my mother said, I always knew you were a bit mad. Because I said, I'm getting married. And she said, who to? I said, an Irish sailor. And she went, there's trouble in her head. And anyway, we got married. And I've got a daughter from that marriage, my Mandy, who just turned 40 just recently in February. And that marriage was, I think it was pretty doomed. Right, you've met in a bar on a ship, you know, like it's not going to go steaming ahead, is it, really, you know? And so it was very volatile, I'll put it that way. And I think we lasted about, I don't know, maybe, I got divorced in 1974. I got married in 69 and divorced in 74. I was number two on the register of quickie divorces, which was a year in Australia at that time. That's when we got our divorces. Real, you know, smart. There was lots of us in the queue, but I was like up front and got the first ticket. You know, like you have to take a ticket and wait. Like I was like number two. So that happened. I'm still drinking. I'm still using. My using then was sort of, it was pretty calm, I suppose, in the sense that I only took acid in them days. And everyone took acid in the 60s. You know, like it was just, everything was painted in beautiful colours. The whole world was like rainbows. And the music was the same, and it was just such a sparkly, happy time. It was really, really nice, you know. This is my memory, okay? Just have a little flashback there. If I didn't, I'd want my money back, wouldn't I? So, yeah, that was the 60s. And then we trudged into the 70s. And, of course, the early 70s were a bit rough for me because, of, you know, going through this mad marriage and got divorced. And by then I'd sort of gone back to school a little bit. And I was working in the fashion industry. And I liked that. You know, it was a lot of fun and... yeah, it was okay, and I had a good job, and it was paying well, and I had it was just my daughter and me, and I had an apartment, and you know life was pretty good. But what was creeping up around me, if I remember back, was this feeling of, you know, I was trying to be responsible, I suppose, and as an addict, that don't come that easy, or not to this one. But I did try and sort of maintain some semblance of normality for my daughter or for myself, really. But there was this little thing that was buzzing around me, you know, and I wasn't particularly using anything other than alcohol at that stage, but it didn't take long before I was sort of knocking around. I knocked around with a lot of people that were on the road, that travelled quite a lot and different things like that, and drugs were fairly plentiful in that sort of environment, and I started sort of picking up more regular, you know, the same old story really. And I had a lot of fun in the 70s, but it was sort of like, I think my life then was really trying to live sort of normal, you know, like earthling style, and the addict, you know, with that crossover thing, you know, the battle of being not one or the other. So I look back at that with not a lot of comfort, really, even though I had a lot of fun and probably achieved things. It was still, you know, I can see my addiction was getting bigger. And it wasn't the fact that I was using loads and loads, but it was my behaviour and the way I felt and just the disease, I guess. you know, sort of mounting itself inside of me to for bigger and better things that were to come. By the late 70s, I was still using amphetamines as my primary drug because I liked the stuff, but by then I was, you know, injecting it, and there was a lot of sulfate around then, you know, crystal meths and all that sort of stuff. And my second husband, who I married in, '79, was a biker. So there was, you know, that sort of lifestyle, which wasn't much different than the merchant seaman, really. It was just, you know, it was just the same stuff, really. And so, there were, you know, there was plenty of drugs around. And it just, as I say, that normality was leaving me, really. And by the 80s, the 80s was a funny decade, really, because there was loads of money around and everyone was a bit crazy, I think, you know, and drugs were really starting to change, and heroin was getting, in Australia, heroin's big, and it's white. I've never seen brown heroin ever in my life. I've heard you talk about it, but I've never actually seen it, because we have China white. And it mixes very well with speed, and I liked that combination, you know. And so the 80s was quite dangerous for me, and I'd started to inject cocaine as well, and, you know, it was getting messy. I was ODing, I was in hospital a few times, physically I was ill, and I contracted hepatitis C at that time, you know. And think, you know, my kids were being brought up by a crazy woman, basically. And I've carried a lot of guilt around that. Not so much now, I've worked through it, but they were little, you know, and never knew who was going to take them to school, and I never knew who was going to pick them up. You know, the kids thought it was great coming home on a Harley. They thought it was magic, you know, because all the other kids had noticed them and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I just look back at the angst of waking up or not waking up in the morning and knowing, and hearing this. I still can't listen to cartoons on the TV or watch them, because that was all, you come out of oblivion and the kids are up and they've put the cartoons on and they're eating their Weet-Bix, and, you know, they need somebody responsible to get them to school. And whoever was standing was the one that took them to school, you know, and quite often that wasn't me. So, you know, I wasn't physically or emotionally available to my kids. And, you know, that's a big part of the disease that takes that sort of capability away from a mother and their children, and also a dad and his kids as well. Anyway, it still went on, you know. And by the late 80s, I decided that it was time that I really needed to stop this. And I went to Thailand on a detox and came back to Australia and still drank and, you know, and messed around for a while. And I didn't know about the rooms or anything then. I hadn't met anyone that had ever got clean. Most of my friends were dying. They weren't getting clean. But in 91, after a couple of suicide attempts and a lot of ODing and a lot of sadness and violence and just really crazy stuff, I had my last use up. So that was in November, end of November. My clean date's the 30th of November 91. So I arrived at the doors of not this fellowship, but our mothership, because that's what was available. I was out in the bush by then in Australia, and there wasn't any meetings at all where I lived, but there was AA about 40 kilometres away, and I went there. And the night that I drove there, it was a road around a very sort of hilly, mountainous, really, the road. And as I drove, the sun was going down, and it came through the trees, all these pine trees. And I just felt that something was going to change that day. Now, I'd never even got to the meeting at that stage, but there was something happened. And I guess I have a pretty strong feeling towards the sun and the moon, and, you know, because of my faith. But it was just, I'll never forget that glimmer of the sun and feeling that, you know, things were going to change for me. And whatever happened at the end of this road, at this meeting, I was going to take full advantage of it. And I did, you know, and I had the willingness to keep going back to these meetings that were quite obscure, to say the least, in the sense of what we have here in London. You know, it wasn't anything like this. It was very small and... But, you know, these people had been through, some of them had used drugs, but they were primarily old alkies, you know. But they had a lot of wisdom and they really supported me. And, you know, after a little while, I started to physically get a little bit better. And my daughter had already left home at that point. I hadn't made any contact with Kathy, my older daughter, at that stage. That happened about 6 months into recovery. And my son was 11, and he picked up at that point glue and stuff like that, which I knew nothing about. I had never known anyone to sniff glue. I was metal MNNA. I didn't, it's not sort of from my era, you know. So, but Luke found the old solvent sort of, and I didn't have any idea. I just thought he was acting out, you know. I was pretty naive, really. For someone that had done drugs for 30 years, I didn't have a bloody clue, really, because it changes all the time, you know. Probably the kids now are using something that we don't even know about. There's always something you missed, isn't there, somewhere, but... anyway... So it was all pretty sort of difficult, the early time, you know. My hep C was sort of rampant and all that stuff, and meetings were hard to get to, and da-da-da-da-da, but I just did not want to pick up again. I wanted to stay clean, and I maintain to anyone that's new in this room, you know, if you have it in your heart to stay clean, you can. No matter where you are, what you do, don't pick up one day at a time. Live your day fully one day at a time, and, you know, you'll be okay. It's sort of bantered around that you have to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I have never heard of that, ever. You know, that's an advantage of living in a big city. It's not something that... I've never heard it in Australia, that saying, or the bridge to normal living. I've never heard either of them. So... I know that the 90 and 90 comes from the Minnesota program in the States, where you were sentenced to 90 days rehab or jail or rehab. The bridge to normal living, I don't know who made that up, but if anyone knows, let me know. Because it's banded around all the time. Where's this bridge? I used to think when I first come over and apparently on about, I've never heard this one before. Anyway, it's just a cliche. It's a cliche, and it is a bridge to normal living, I guess, you know, if you want to use that one. What's normal? What is normal? You know, my normality today, how much longer have I got, Gary?
Just over 15 minutes.
Okay. We'll get into recovery and stuff, I think. I've talked long enough about my mad drug use. Yeah, anyway, in 1996, I thought, I think I'll go to England. 5 weeks later, I was here. And I'm moving again now, and I bet you in 5 weeks I'm out of here. I'm going to do it. So, I decided that my daughter had already come over here, you know, which is sort of the rite of passage for an Australian kid to come over to England and work. You know, most of them do it. And she'd finished her apprenticeship. She was a hairdresser, and she'd finished that, and she'd saved a bit of money. And she came over here, and I missed her terribly. And she came back, I think in 93 or something, and for a visit, and then again in about 95. And she said, "Why don't you come over, Mum?" You know. And at that stage, I was back painting. You know, I did a degree in fine art and design, and I was doing quite well with my paintings, and I even had one hung in the National Gallery in Melbourne, so I was pretty chuffed about that, and it was going all right. And I thought, well, I'll go to London and paint, you know. I don't know who I thought I was. Tracy Emin or somebody. I thought, I'll just pop over to London and be this famous artist. God, I don't know. But anyway, I got a job in a sex shop instead. It's a great leveller, isn't it? Come to London. Yeah, I thought I'd be hanging things in the over the road here, you know, very soon. But I was in a sex shop in Soho without 3 days after getting off the plane. My daughter was working there at the time, Moonlight, and so she said, "Do you want to be our summer girl, Mum?" It was in June. "Do you want to be our summer girl in slinkies?" If anyone says they know it, I know what you've been up to. Slinkies is in Walker's Court. It's gone now anyway, just near Raymond's Review Bar there. So that's where it was. Members used to come in and see me sometimes, you know. If they were having a bit of trouble, they'd pop into the sex shop. "Just want a little chat, Annie." And we used to sell sort of marital aids, they're called, aren't they? And I used to get different pieces for the girls, and I'd go in a meeting and they'd all be smiling. And some of the boys too. So, yeah, that was my first job. But I had to wait for... I've got an education certificate I can teach, and I had to wait for all my papers to be cleared and everything, and I got a job with people with disabilities, sort of as a project worker doing art and stuff like that. And I worked in primary school as well, teaching, and I wasn't sort of... I still kept the sex shop job going as well. I did that for 7 years. That was me moonlighting job. I used to work there Saturday nights. I loved it. It was really good. Because all the tourists were out there. It was just fun, you know. I like fun. I like being just something different, you know. But I got my own job as well, and working with disabilities and things like that. And that was really good. But then I got tired of that. My hip was sort of getting pretty mad. So I had the interferon in... I think it was about 6 years ago. I can't really remember now, but it was a good while ago. And when I came through that, I got headhunted, actually, as a nanny. And I've been working in this circle of people in Muswell Hill for ever since that time as a nanny. And I looked after little Wilson as well, you know, Gary's little boy, and it was really, really nice. And I'm still doing that today. I've got two little boys I look after, and you know, it's a fantastic job. And when you think about it, like this mad woman on merchant ships or riding on the back of Harleys, and now I'm entrusted with the most precious things of some families. That, you know, it's about change. You know, this whole journey is about changing and tapping into who you really are. Because when we use, I don't believe that is just the escape, and who we are is locked inside, that we can't access that anymore. There's something that goes on that covers all that, and we have to be another person when we're using. I know I did. I had to be somebody else, and it was fun, a lot of it, but it wasn't true to who I really am. You know, I do believe that I'm a caring person, and you know, I care about people and what happens to them, and children particularly. And I wasn't present for my kids. And when I work with the children now, my total focus is on that child. I don't have to think about whether the rent's paid, it's not my business in the house that I'm in, or, you know, all those extra things that you have to think about with your own kids. So it's a, you know, it's a magical job for me, and I really love it. But it's coming to a close. You know, because my recovery has taught me a lot of things. You know, I've just been working through the steps again, which is, I think, my fifth time. And it's opened up more for me this time in the sense of looking further within of what I need to do in my life. And a new chapter is looming. And I've been in London for about 14 years or something, and I've really enjoyed it, but I need to change. I need to move away from here now. And my daughter has a house in Broadstairs in Kent. That's where they live. And my son will probably settle there too when he comes back. He lives in Cyprus now. He works there. So a few people have seen, I've been putting it on Facebook, and a few people have said to me, you're going. And yes, I'm going. I'm going to move, you know. And the fellowship is very small there. There's one meeting in Broadstairs, and I know someone that goes to that meeting, and I've been in touch with her, and I feel that's, you know, there'll be a new chapter of my life. I want to get back to painting again and just doing something different, you know, and it's time I retired anyway. You know, I never thought this was going to happen, but the day is looming. And if I don't make the changes now, it'll be, like, too late because, you know, I want to go down there and start another realm of my life and enjoy some more things. So it's Tara London, you know, but, I mean, it's only a bloody hour away. God, you can be back on the train. Hour and 15 minutes it is on the fast train. So I'll still be able, you know, I'm still close enough to come and visit. And of course, my sponsees in the last week are going, oh, you're leaving us. I said, no, you can come to the beach. We can do the steps on the beach. You know, it'll be all right. I'm not deserting anybody. You know, I thought, oh, what about me? What am I going to do for me? I tell you, they're not bad, are they? I have to go to Cambridge to see my sponsor, you know. God. But you know what it's like? It's about the change, isn't it, for all of us? You know, we feel that we're so quick at feeling we're going to be deserted. It's just amazing, you know. And I've been with the sponsee today and we were talking about some stuff. And we were talking about I was telling her how quickly the madness comes back for me and how I can act out so quickly. And a situation happened the other day, and I was late picking the kids up. My watch was wrong, and I picked the kids up late from school, and I got really angry. And I wasn't angry with me, particularly at that stage. I was angry with all the blocks that were coming up that were making me late. And then these two little kids are looking at me, you know, and I had to swing it round really quickly that it wasn't about me, and that's something I've learned in here, is that you've got to stop that and, you know, focus on what's real and what the priority is of whatever you're doing. And I feel really safe with that, and I've learned that here. You know, if we share all this stuff, and it's really, really important for me anyway. So, you know, because when my head's a-ropping, I don't like it anymore, you know. How long have I got, Gary? Oh, goes on and on, doesn't it? I've had some lovely experiences here in London, you know. I did in Australia too. The first part of my recovery is very, very special to me, and I have a special loyalty to the mothership, you know, for all of us that have, you know, and I'm sure all of us have been touched by AA at some time, you know, and I have a, you know, special feeling about that fellowship. I don't go there now, only as a visitor, and I don't share in an AA meeting because I'm a member of this fellowship. But I do like to go and visit and hear people sometimes. But this fellowship has given me a greater expanse of my background of identification. Because I did use, and I used as an addict, and I am an addict. You know, there's no two ways about it. You put anything in front of me, I want double that immediately. And it doesn't matter what it is. And I've had to learn, and I've learned it in these rooms, that more is a dangerous thing. You know, just take what you need. And And that's a hard one for me, because if I go shopping, I want three pair of shoes. I don't want one boxy pair. I do not want one pair of shoes or one dress. I want, my number is three. And when I used to go to the pub, I always used to buy three drinks. I used to drink Jack Daniels, and I'd always buy three, because by the time you drank one, you want another one. So you might as well get three. And then you drink them, and then when you're on the second one, you say another three. So they keep coming, see? And I'm the same with cakes, biscuits, chocolates, anything, anything. And I don't want to be like that anymore, so I'm trying to readjust my brain to just accept what I need. And I'll tell you what, it's really hard, but I did it with drugs, and Peter spoke about cigarettes too. I haven't smoked. Now, this one will freak you right out, right? I haven't smoked for probably 18 years. And my first sponsor, who is a sponsee brother to Gary, lovely guy in the States, he wouldn't take me through step four till I stopped smoking. How about that? And I say it to my girls, and there's a couple in the room tonight, you're supposed to stop smoking. They haven't stopped smoking. They're still on the fags, aren't they? They tell me they're up, but I know. I can sniff them out. I don't know. The reason that he told me that is because about pushing down emotions, you know, and he took me through this little practice. There were still smoking meetings in those days, and he showed me how people, when they shared, they'd light up a cigarette and push everything down. And so I took his advice, and I'm really glad I did, because I wanted to stop smoking anyway, so it was beneficial. And now the freedom of that is really good. So if anyone wants to stop, give it a go, because it's really nice, especially around your step four. And you think you need a bag, you don't really. Yeah, so it's, you know, I've had lots of experiences, and, you know, I'll be 20 years this year, and you know, I find that I need to know more about this. You know, I've met some lovely people, and this is my life now. You know, it enables me to do other things, make changes, meet new people, go to different places. And, it's all good stuff. And I still enjoy it. In fact, I enjoy it more today than what I did in November 91 when I first came in, you know, because it's just opened so many things for me. So thank you, Shelley asked me to share tonight, and thank you for that, and thank you to my home group for allowing me to share, and I wish you all lots of love. Thank you.